This is Mae Bressel. It is tape number 861, June the 6th, 1988. Before I get into the material, I want to say that I decided to discontinue making the weekly tapes. It's been 17 years, one tape a week for that length of time. Now I want to start writing books and travel and read a lot of the books that I have here and clear out a lot of the articles that are in boxes around the house. And mostly I want to also, besides going through the books and articles, begin writing some material myself. So through July, up till number 868, and that will be the last tape cassette that I'll get out in the format that we've had all of these years. So don't plan beyond that, and don't send in checks beyond that. There are a lot of important deaths to update here that I have been getting behind because there's so much news that floods the desk, and all of you have the same problem keeping up with all of this news. But there's one that is significant about America and says a lot about America, and I can't pass this one up. And this has to do with the death of the airman, the recruit Lee Marecki, 19 years old from Wisconsin, who died in the Navy. Maybe you, I'm sure all of you read one article or so, in the Navy training, life-saving instruction course that he was taking. And the thing about this story is that, of course, the family were told that he died of natural causes. We have our apparent heart attacks, we have the natural causes, and then they began to get some anonymous letters or letters telling them to look into it, and they began to challenge the federal government, the authorities in the Navy about what was going on. And as a matter of fact, this case could possibly, according to the attorney of the family, could possibly challenge the traditional law that the federal government can't be sued for the death of military personnel in the line of duty. The family members say that they originally were told that their son's death was an accident, and 2 months later, five instructors from the Navy Rescue Swimming School were charged with involuntary manslaughter and conspiracy to commit battery. And the important thing about this story, the doubly tragic thing about this story, is that Marecki was drowned after he was left the pool, and he didn't want to go back into the pool. The officers ordered him to go back into the pool against his will, and they pushed his head underwater. And then, while they were doing this, before they put his head under the water, they told the other Navy people around him to turn their backs to the pool so they wouldn't see him drown. And they were to sing the national anthem as loudly as they could to drown out Marecki's screams. Now, the question here is, what does the national anthem mean? And these fellows turned their back knowing that one of their classmates, who didn't want to go back into the pool, was screaming and was drowned by the officers or the people over him, and these sailors wanted their subordinates to drown out the sound. Of all the songs, the national anthem was sung while a member of the armed services, who was obviously singled out for some reasons or other, was murdered, absolutely murdered, cold-blooded murder, and they're not being charged with first-degree murder. A Navy rescue instructor yelled, "Get him," as he was being forced back into the pool before a panic-stricken recruit was forced back into the swimming pool, where he died, and these four or five got him, and he was screaming, "Leave me alone, I quit. I'm quitting the rescue school," and he was exhausted from the other swimming. He was panicking, and Mr. Marecki was held under the water by the other people, and according to the accounts, he was yelling and screaming. He didn't want to go back, and of course, holding his head under the water and making the others turn their back means that they knew they were going to drown him because they didn't want the others to see the struggle going where they actually killed this person in the Navy training. There are a lot of inquiries going on. It's been on the news, and a lot of times I don't touch matters that I know you can get from the establishment or other alternative press, but this is one of the most tragic, and one thing that's lacking in the so-called left press, whether it's Nation, In These Times, Guardian, People's Daily World, is that they write about deaths of third world persons and labor people and so forth. But I think this is significant when this country does this to their own in the Navy school and holds their head underwater and murders them. This is a significant because it tells you what life is worth to people in our military, what direction we're going into. And naturally, then the third world and the labor leaders and the Indians and so forth aren't worth anything when the people in the Navy Academy choose to drown a person and play the Star Spangled Banner, the national anthem. It's very, very sad. And the circumstances of having those classmates turn their back while they had to sing the national anthem is horrendous to me, the implications of this particular murder. Now, when Ronald Reagan was in Russia for the summit, starting May 29th, there was an article in the Washington Post by Jean Kirkpatrick that was of extreme interest to me, not that I like what she says very much. The title was, "What Questions Did Mike Deaver Not Want Me to Raise?" And the point about this article is that Jean Kirkpatrick was saying that Mike Deaver was talking to her in 1983. She said, this won't come out in a kiss-and-tell book. But in 1983, at the Gridiron Dinner, George Shultz had settled in as Secretary of State, and the President's longtime associate, Bill Clark, was National Security Advisor, and I represented the United Nations in New York. And Deaver said in this conversation with Jean Kirkpatrick, "I may as well tell you this. You'll have to find out sometime anyway. The president may have an opportunity to make peace for our times, and I think you will have an opportunity to make peace," she repeats it, "for our times." "That would be wonderful," I said. "Everyone notices the influence you have on the president," Deaver said. But he said there are few people he listens to, and he of course, listened to Michael Deaver a lot. And he said maybe it's because he's really interested in foreign policy that he listens to you, Jean Kirkpatrick. He was saying, "Listen, he listened to her. Maybe it's because he's really interested in foreign policy, and I am too," he interjected. "Anyway," Deaver said, "when the time comes that the president has the opportunity to make peace, we can't have you and Bill Clark raising questions. We just can't have you and Bill Clark around raising questions," she repeated. Jean Kirkpatrick said, "I was stunned. Even in retrospect, I find it incredible that this presidential aide, Michael Deaver, with no known role in foreign affairs, had decided that two senior officials, William Clark and herself, Jean Kirkpatrick, had to be moved out to prevent them from raising questions. There were rumors circulating in Washington at the time that Deaver was working with Armin Hammer and that they were trying to change Reagan's views of the Soviet Union and bring around a new expanded entente between the Soviet Union." And, of course, they said the First Lady, according to these rumors, had been enlisted in the project using her best friend Michael Deaver and reportedly made promises, or someone had, of a favorable press that alluded to a possible Nobel Peace Prize for her husband. Now, what is interesting about this article is that William Clark really had no more knowledge of foreign affairs than Michael Deaver. But at the time the Korean Airline went down, and this was in August 83, Michael Deaver, not Michael Deaver, but William Clark, was the man in charge of the response to the Korean Airline affair. He was the first one that went on, there was a quote on the media that saying the people on the KAL weren't killed, that they landed at another island. And later it turned out that this was untrue, that they were just stalling this to get their response back to the Soviet Union. And Bill Clark was working close with Oliver North in writing the responses against, this is the evil empire part coming out, the terrible, terrible Russians. And if you remember Jean Kirkpatrick at the United Nations, she was screaming about the KAL. It was embarrassing to be a representative of the United States and hear her talking about the KAL without a piece of evidence yet, blasting them. I'll look up my quotes. I saved all those articles of William Clark and Jean Kirkpatrick that they were attacking the Soviet Union. And so was Ronald Reagan at that time. But what happened afterwards, and this is the part that I think is interesting to note, is that the Korean Airline, there's a lot of evidence that has been suppressed on the truth of the Korean Airline. And I still believe, and many people do, that it was an American spy plane that was sent over to test the responses of the Soviet Union as the plane entered. And, of course, the Soviet Union knows what they did. They know what they were saying. And I think they were pissed off. Of course they were. At the response of America before the facts were in. And those facts are still suppressed today. There's been lawsuits, and those facts are suppressed today. Now, if the Soviet Union caught on to what was really happening, and if they wanted to tone down Ronald Reagan to prepare for anything like a 1988 4-5 summits with the Soviet Union, Reagan couldn't change overnight his rhetoric or his policy. But if they wanted to get a Reagan right away and say, now, come on, we've had enough. The first two people he had to unload were William Clark and Gene Kirkpatrick. And he did unload them, and they haven't been heard of since. And if Russia was evil, and if Russia did what they said they did to the Korean airline, William Clark and Gene Kirkpatrick would still be part of the administration and have all the glory that they wanted, and even she wanted to be head of the National Security Council. Now, in lieu of that, a new article has come out in the Washington Post. And this article's April 16th, 1988, last month. And this article supports, I believe, and goes along with the similar article, not similar, but the story I wrote on the Korean airline that was in Hustler magazine in February 1988, where I said Pilot Chun was under mind control, that he was told by his superiors to just keep going. Somebody had told him just keep going in the direction off course. Going off course, he would be assured to be destroyed. But I made note that he had no panic. He didn't show any anxiety. They were warning him that the Russian plane was around, that he was in the wrong direction, and he simply asked for elevation of feet and sailed into the sky, and the ship was blown up, and the ship was meant to be blown up. And, of course, again, Clark and North and Gene Kirkpatrick headed the lambasting along with a group of others. Now, in this Washington Post article, the new article, it's based upon new testimony coming out in a lawsuit in Korea. There's still these lawsuits going down in Korea. And remember, about a year ago, there was information pertaining to those lawsuits that the pilot's wife, the first chief pilot, Chung's wife, said that he told her he was not coming back that night, that he was going away, and he'd never come home. Sort of like the Manchurian candidate in reverse, the Americans or the Koreans doing it to him for the purposes of Cold War. And so I want to share this article. It's by Douglas Fever. The pilot of the ill-fated Korean airline, 007, shot by the Soviets in 1983, knew he was off course near Soviet territory, but he was afraid he would be disciplined by his airline and lose face if he attempted to correct the error, a colleague has theorized in the court proceedings. Now, the colleague I'm going to talk, this one that they're quoting, is the man who trained Chung. And the idea is that, well, I'm off course, but I'd be embarrassed to turn back when many planes have gone off course and turned back, is still hiding the fact that he knew he was off course and kept going. That's the point I want to stress. The article says the colleague testified that he tried by radio to warn the pilot of 007 something was amiss. The colleague's aircraft, KAL Flight 015, was trailing Flight 007 that night, was right behind him that night. And it was a long time till he could testify in court. The Koreans have stopped him from talking. The shooting down of the KAL was more than 300 miles off course and occurred over Soviet waters September 1, 1983, killing 269 people. The reason for the monstrous navigational error has never been established because there are no surviving witnesses, and an extensive effort to recover the flight's data cockpit records have failed. The result has been at least 10 books, a newsletter that continues to this day, a multitude of theories, including Mae Brussels, including one that the United States used the flight to tickle Soviet radar and reap an electronic intelligence harvest. The theorists will be intrigued, these theorists, with a key new document, a deposition taken in Seoul last September, 87, more than 4 years after the drowning, by Captain Park Yong-man, the pilot of the other KAL jetliner, who has been a reluctant witness. Park has long been the target of U.S. liability lawyers. He has declined to testify earlier and suggests in his deposition he was forced by the KAL to retire, then paid full salary to keep his mouth shut about his version of what happened, and now he has it in the court. He said that the court documents have to do illustrate his retirement in 1955. The Korean Airlines said that was normal to retire, but he felt it was unusual, and he resented being fired at the time. Most aviation experts believe the crew members of 007 had misprogrammed the plane's inertial navigation system on the onboard computers that guided the plane. This is all three. Many pilots told reporters that appropriate checks by the alert crew, such as any error, would be discovered and corrected. Park's deposition put him squarely in the camp of those experts and adds a possible motive for the 007 crew, headed by Captain Chung Bin-yin, not reacting to an INS error, either by seeking help or attempting to return to Anchorage where the flight started. And that's exactly what I was writing about. Incidentally, there are new subscribers to these tapes who do not have the article I wrote for Hustler. If you want a reprint of that, send a self-addressed stamped envelope and I'll send it to you. On the state of mind of Captain Chun, and of course this article says he was not reacting to the error and he was not seeking help and he did not attempt to return to Anchorage. The INS carried by Flight 007 had three computers. One was coupled to the pilot's autopilot, a second to the co-pilot's autopilot, the third monitors the other two pilots. And if there's any disagreement between the pilots and the co-pilots, the third system alerts the crew. And if all three are in agreement, there is no alert. The INS totally depends upon people for its initial information. People who feed the information into it, they depend upon, including geographic coordinates of where it's supposed to go. And if the coordinates are inaccurately entered into all three systems, the plane could return to the airport where it started the flight with the computers to be reset. A fully loaded 747 carries 350,000 gallons of fuel. They would have to dump it into the ocean. It may cost $19,000. The cost is about that much. And the explanation of the person writing this article or the friend of Chung's that went down is the possibility that it might have irritated passengers to go back to Anchorage or the airline officials if you wasted the gasoline. Now, which is more expensive, taking them back? Since when do passengers have the say of their own safety? Did they take a vote of the 269 and say, are you willing to just keep going? We're off course. Or knowing they were off course because this pilot trained Chung and was telling him at the time what was happening, that the passengers could hardly be irritated, including Representative Larry McDonald, if he knew he had a choice to go alive to Anchorage or dead over the Soviet Union. Dead passengers can't be irritated. What does this mean? And airline officials could replace the fuel, which is cheaper, $19,000 worth of fuel, or a new KAL, or all the lawsuits against KAL and Boeing and the payments for covering up what happened. Those are the two most feeble things I've read in a long, long time. This article continues, quoting the man who trained Chung, I would say a host of factors were involved in this case, Park was saying in his deposition. Number one was Chung's credibility was at stake. Number two, the prestige and dignity. And three, the Captain Chung was picked as a prestige pilot. So there again, he must have been taken into consideration what we call face. Now, again, this is the mind control of the man. His credibility is at stake. If the system was set wrong when they left Anchorage, the INS system, why is he saving face? His credibility isn't at stake if it's set wrong. Is his prestige and dignity, does he have to be suicidal because he's told his prestige and dignity is gone? Well, I believe he was under mind control and continued until that blew up because the political implications of the KAL going down were tremendous. And not only did we get rid of late Representative Larry McDonald, but he was chairman of Western Goals, and Western Gold then went into the hands of Carl Spitz Channel, the close associate of Ollie North and Betsy North's fathers on the board of Western Gold. John Singlob's on the board of Western Gold, and it was their organization that was putting information into Washington from computers in the police department. And the whole point is that Western Gold remained protected after all of this. Carl Spitz Channel pleaded guilty with the Iran-Contra affair a year and a half, almost, at least a year, and there's not even a word about his sentencing or anything about that. But poor Chung's credibility would be at stake if he went back. His prestige would be back, and he was picked as a prestigious pilot. Well, why was he picked for that night? The most prestigious pilot, the pilot of the president of South Korea, with Larry McDonald, the chairman of the John Birch Society, on that airplane. Most of you know, some of you don't, that when John Birch, who worked for United States Intelligence, was killed in China after the war, the Birch Society began their organizations and said, their branches and their main organizations saying this was the first death of World War III. So the man who the John Birch Society was named after was killed in Asia, and now you have the chairman of the John Birch Society. He was picked as a prestige pilot, so as a prestige pilot, you don't try to save the lives of the people on the plane. I'm going at great length of this story because it's so important into the effect it had. And then also, according to Deaver now, when this was over and all the brahu was over, William Clark and Jean Kirkpatrick were shelved. And Reagan then, and maybe Nancy with her outside contacts, that who were astrologers but also advisors, stopped that craziness against Russia. Russia said, stop that craziness against us. And then the wheels started turning as early as the fall of 1983 to stop the anti-Soviet line and start the summits. Now, one of the people that moved from working for Senator Henry Jackson, he was in Washington on the board of Boeing, the plane that went down. He died the day after KAL went down. And his assistant, Richard Pearl, moved up into the Defense Department after the KAL for this violent anti-Soviet rhetoric. But you see, Richard Pearl was shelved when the president went to Russia, and there were so many political implications of this event. But this article certainly illustrates, and there's a little bit more, the mind of the pilot, and for me, confirms a lot of what I knew happened in the point of sacrificing Larry McDonald, the head of the Birch Society, the chairman of Western Gold, starting off this Cold War rhetoric almost to the battle point. Some people wanted to go to war, and now this testimony is coming out about the mind of the pilot. And what I had in my article for Hustler was that Chung was under mind control and had no free will to go the direction he did, in which case Russia had no choice but to shoot the plane down. Now, this article continues in the Washington Post. Captain Chung must have been afraid of being put to sanction or punishment if he dumped the fuel in the ocean. This is Park saying this again. Isn't that silly? To dump $18,000 worth of fuel is punishment when you know you're going to be killed. He testified that he was aware of incidents prior to the KAL where KAL pilots had encountered navigational problems, dumped the fuel and returned, and had been disciplined. But discipline is different than being dead. KAL in court documents confirms navigational errors of at least three other INS-equipped KAL jets prior to the tragedy that happened the end of 1983, August 83. However, KAL said no pilot was ever fired as a result of fuel dumping incidents. Some were disciplined and some were not. Park was forced to retire from the KAL shortly before he and other employees were to be deposed in the United States on the civil litigation of the KAL. And this September in Korea, he declined to testify earlier but decided, I had to do it because otherwise I would have to lie, and I didn't want to do it. In an errata sheet filed with the court in December of last year, Park wrote, I understood that I was being asked to assist the Korean Airlines in evading and hiding the truth from the United States court. That's why he wouldn't come to the United States, even though no one expressly told me to lie. And that's when Chung's wife said that her husband said he wasn't coming home. The civil litigation here in Washington was brought by relatives of those killed on the KAL. The defendants
were the KL, Boeing, and Litton Industry that made the INS system. All but the KL had been dismissed as defendants by Chief District Court Judge Aubrey Robinson Jr. in Washington, D.C. In one document, the KL attorney said Parks' deposition resulted in absolutely no factual testimony, which would probably serve as a basis for a trial for whether the KL was guilty of willful misconduct in the shooting down. He couldn't provide that. Under civil law that applies to international flights, plaintiffs have to prove willful misconduct on the part of a defendant, or they are limited to a maximum of $75,000 apiece in damages. Captain Park at one time was Captain Chun's commander in the South Korean Air Force. On the night of the KL shooting, Captain Park and Captain Chun made refueling stops together at Anchorage on the way to Seoul. Flight 007, piloted by Chun, left 14 minutes before Park's flight, 015, piloted by Park. Both flights were scheduled to take the same North Pacific route, known as R-20. Aviation charts for the route clearly states that planes straying from it into the Soviet airspace may be fired on without warning. Early in the flight, according to radar data, Flight 007 began to stray off course. It was still within what is considered normal limits when it flew beyond the range of civilian air radar. They couldn't keep it up. On long overwater flights, there is no civilian radar monitoring, making accurate cockpit navigation essential. But pilots do check in with air traffic controllers by radio when they pass regular checkpoints. Several times that night, Flight 015, right behind Chung's, relayed the routine reports between 007 and the air traffic controllers, where the controllers were unable to get normal communications. As a result, Park testified he became worried. I myself and my co-pilot as well thought that something unusual was happening. He radioed 007 and was told by Chung that Chung was encountering strong winds. Park told Chung that wasn't the situation with Flight 015, that they weren't having strong winds, which was supposedly flying the same route. Park testified he intended his communications to serve as a warning to Captain Chung that something was wrong. And he could have also, Chung was 300 miles off course, but the black box is not available. And that is the latest in the KAL story, which I want to update because the article I wrote, I believe, is a solid article based upon a lot of material that I put together at the time. And as new things come out, I like to hold them against what I wrote. And Chung is complaining about weather and nothing else. Now, what else were they talking about? The guy who trained him must say, Chung, you're off course. You don't say, I'm going up 30,000 feet or it's windy here. And the other guy says, no, it's not windy where I am. That's not what you talk about if you're on course checking in or you're not checking in, or you say get back or you're going to get your ship blown up. It was stated quite clearly it would be blown up if it was in that direction. So there was communication with the man who trained this pilot. This pilot was formerly the pilot for the President of South Korea. He was on a prestigious route. He couldn't go back, couldn't save face, okay? And what happened was he continued until the Soviets forced him down by shooting him down. And by shooting him down, they got Larry McDonald, the head of Western Goals and the John Birch Society, and started the Cold War rhetoric that was so massive that I'm sure that Nancy and the Soviet Union got together with Ronnie and said, cool it. And the middleman between that would be Michael Deaver, who waits until 1988 to tell Gene Kirkpatrick that William Clark, this was Ronald Reagan's closest friend from California. He made him a justice on the Supreme Court. Clark was the guy who brought Helene von Damm into this country, was part of the operation of bringing her to this country. He was he left the NSC into silence. Gene Kirkpatrick is, for all purposes, obscured for the column, except the column she writes, and the president made four trips to the Soviet Union after all these things took place. We'll take about a 30-second break, turn this tape over, and then I'll continue with some more on the summit, the election, and the news surrounding those two events.